Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
Welcome to today's Business Matters with your host, Professor David Harding. Today, we'll be exploring how data helps or hinders effective marketing. The traditional image of marketeers has changed significantly over recent years. Marketing professionals are now better equipped than ever. They're now able to exploit data and to develop products and services to tailor customer solutions. This is arguably truly the age of the customer. But how has this impacted today's modern marketing professional? To explore this subject further, I'd like to welcome today's guest, Michael Collins. Michael is a consultant specialising in data-driven marketing and has over 30 years practical experience of helping organisations achieve their commercial objectives by applying both a sound data strategy and CRM. He's a chartered marketeer and a fellow of the Institute of Direct and Digital Marketing and has taught database marketing and CRM at several university business schools. Welcome, Michael. Thank you for joining us today. Michael, if I could just briefly ask you to take us through your career and maybe dwell on some of your more recent data-driven marketing success stories.
Okay. I started out as a marketing management on what is commonly called the client side, working for originally in the music industry and then into lighting and ending up in car rental and leasing. From there, I sort of hopped over the counter into consultancy and was working with a company that was seen very much as the pioneers of data-driven marketing in the UK, specialising in the automotive industry. And I helped develop that company out of that sector specialism and ended up as a main board director of the group. We were taken over by an international marketing agency group who didn't really understand what data-driven marketing was about, I have to say. Okay. And so I set up my own consultancy as part of that group, ran it for a year, and then left and set it up as an independent consultancy, and that was about 25 years ago. During that time, I've worked with companies in most business sectors, retailing, financial services, travel, automotive, membership and charitable organisations. Probably one of the biggest successes has been I was involved in the first ever application of data to drive variable versions of a consumer magazine that the company was sending out to their customers. This was before the days of internet. It was before the days of digital print. This was all traditional printing, and what we were able to do is build segments of the database that had different preferences so that they could actually read about things they were interested in and therefore start building a relationship with the brand. Since then, I've been involved in probably with about 120 clients over those years, mainly involved in helping them to understand better how they should be collecting data and how they should be using it and how they should be looking upon it as an asset of the organisation rather than just the names and addresses of their customers. And I think probably the biggest successes have been those where this kind of data culture has been assumed within the organisation, which really oils the wheels of the data-driven marketing activity.
Ah, interesting. So it's from a customer's perspective, given the availability now of more insights and data, how would you suggest that customer experience has changed in the last 10 to 15 years, if at all?
It has changed, and I think most consumers will say that they tend to get too much communication. You hear of people being bombarded with certainly these days with emails from different companies. I think the difference has been the ability to get closer to one-to-one marketing, but with the marketing companies failing in some cases to recognise just how much or how little a customer actually wants from them. I always say that there is a spectrum of involvement, as I call it, between the customer that says, if I don't get every single communication going, I think you don't love me anymore, to the guy at the other end that says, I know where you are when I want you. And either of those two extremes could be your most loyal customer.
Right, okay.
Okay, so the secret is knowing where each customer is on that spectrum. And that's what I help clients do. Very often, they don't regard that. They just think, well, the more we send, the more we're likely to get a response. And unfortunately, in these days of how easy it is to stop receiving these things, you're more likely to get people to unsubscribe than to get them to buy.
Interesting. So what would you say is driving this? Because it feels like a chicken and egg type scenario where...
What's driving it is the ability to do it. So in other words, it's saying, you know, if you go back when I first started in direct marketing, everybody thought it was absolutely wonderful that Reader's Digest was sending out letters that said, not only are we approaching households in High Street, but we've selected the Collins family for this offer, which nowadays anybody can do with Mail Merge and Excel and Word. We're now getting to the situation where they can do far more exciting things because they know more information about the customer. But what they're not doing necessarily is tempering that with how do we want to build this relationship with a customer. It's throw as much as we can at the customer and hopefully some of it's going to stick.
Interesting. So arguably that's quite a traditional approach to marketing.
It's quite a traditional approach. What has become of the day, if you like, is the method of delivery of the message.
Right, okay.
Okay, so nothing has really changed. Marketing is still marketing. I know, I hear clients talk about, well, you know, we have a digital marketing specialist. Okay, well, that's somebody that knows how to create emails and blogs and e-newsletters and this kind of thing. But when it comes down to it, all you're saying is instead of putting a piece of paper in an envelope and sending it, you're doing something digitally. But what you're actually doing is no different to what we were doing 30 years ago in getting a message to a potential customer.
Interesting. And I guess maybe it's the volume of interactions probably increase as well through the availability of these.
Through the availability and the fact that it's so much cheaper to send an email than it is to send a letter. We've only seen the Royal Mail figures a couple of weeks ago that came out to say how many millions they've lost since the move away from direct mail and into electronic mail. But when you look on the other side of the coin and look at the research that's been done by the Direct Marketing Association and other type of industry bodies, there is a greater preference, in fact, for direct mail than there is for email amongst consumers.
So it's a swing and roundabout type of process where it's gone from one direction.
Well, when it costs upwards of 50-60p to send out a communication to something that might cost a fraction of a penny, it's very hard to convince your financial director of the benefit of using the mail.
The more traditional.
More traditional methods.
Yeah. Methods. So bearing that in mind, then, so how would you describe an ideal data-driven marketing process from a marketeer's perspective? Or is there actually one?
Well, yeah, from the marketer's point of view, it's a question of saying, have I identified how am I going to get my data? Have I explored all the touch points that I have with customers and prospects and other contacts with whom I want to build a relationship? Am I maximising those as opportunities for either collecting new data or verifying the data that I've got now? And then once I've got that data, how am I going to manage it, making sure it's up to date, that the quality is maintained, and then how am I going to use that to drive communications and drive the relationship and the customer journey, as people are calling it.
So it sounds like you would still need to have the sort of top-down view of marketing, but driven by, say, a marketing strategy and a marketing plan. So those traditional
still need your marketing strategy, but to support that marketing strategy, you need a data strategy. So how am I going to use the data? What data is coming into my business? But even more so is, what data would I like to come into my business that I'm not collecting now? And how do I go about getting that? Because if I had that bit of data, I could be that much more specific and that much more relevant to the in the communications that I'm sending out.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
Have you had a lot of experience around the buying and selling or exchange of data between marketing organisations, potentially without the consumer's knowledge? Is that a fairly common practice?
It does happen. Obviously, it's illicit. Especially under the new general data protection regulations that are coming in over the next couple of years, which are on the statute books now but are going to be enforced from 2018, you need obviously specific opt-ins to be able to do that. But as it stands at the moment, you still need a customer's opt-in to be able to pass their information to a third party. They need to be told that, and they need to have the opportunity to say, "I don't want that to happen to my my."
Okay.
I mean, there are instances where it does occur and has to occur. So, for example, if you're buying, I do quite a lot of work in the travel sector. So, if you're buying a holiday from a travel agent, you can't stop that travel agent from passing your details to the airline or the tour operator, because as a function of delivering your tickets and everything, they need to know who you are.
Yes.
But that's something that's very different to saying, I've got a bunch of people that a third party might be interested in. I'm going to sell these names and addresses to that third party. And this is the kind of thing that caused all the furore last year and previously in the charity sector, where there was a huge exchange of data going on between charities, and unfortunately ended in a very serious outcome.
Yes. Yep. So is that, given what you've just explained then, in terms of data ownership, let's call it, are there any other sort of, in your experience, are there any other sort of fairly typical or common mistakes which marketeers make, given their access to the data, more generic?
Well, the biggest mistake is not having any kind of governance in place for making sure that the data remains up to date.
Right. Okay.
You've spent a lot of time, effort, money collecting this data, and in the hope that you're going to make your communications relevant. As soon as that relevance stops, the customer is obviously going to lose faith in the brand and not particularly want to do business with you. The other areas where I think they make the biggest mistakes is in the areas of not listening enough to what their customers actually want. Now, this is something that marketers have been saying for ages. You've had market research to try and understand what people want. But if people are actually saying, we want to know about this, we want to know about that, we don't want to know about the other, it behoves those marketers to have the ability to store that information and to use that to drive the relevance of the communications that are sent out to them.
So it sounds like if marketers or marketing professionals are able to ask customers the specifics of what they want to hear about, and then they don't follow through with that commitment, then that's a key attribute of customer frustration, I would suggest.
And customer frustration, and you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot, because if the customer has actually said, I'd love to have a relationship with you on this basis, and you try and do something else, then there's a disconnect there, obviously.
It breaks that contract, essentially. Okay, so looking to the future, maybe the short-term future then, again, from your perspective and based on your experiences of the last 10 to 15 years or so, do you see any new challenges on the immediate horizon for both marketers and customers, maybe?
Well, for the marketers, the new challenge has to be the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulations.
Right.
Now is the time that they need to be considering how they've acquired the data and going back out to their customers and getting the necessary opt-ins, opt-outs, preferences, etc. Because it'll be too late once the the new law is actually being enforced. The key challenge to marketers is going to be compliance with the new GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, in as much as now is the time that they should be undertaking due diligence in communicating with their customers and other contacts, making sure that their opt-ins, their options, their preferences are up to date and can be seen to have done that as best practice. The other thing that I would suggest that the challenges are is challenges in terms of introducing data culture within the organisation. So much money, time and effort is spent on introducing strategies and very often new technology, specific software for this kind of activity, which really ends up not being used or not being used to its fullest advantage because there isn't the data culture within the organisation for people to understand how much of an asset that data is and how much easier it makes their work if they're working with people that have that are willing to receive the marketing message and are responsive.
Okay, no, thank you. Thanks, Michael. So, and then in terms of the longer term, I would suspect that this growth in data or this availability of data, it's not going to stop. It's just going to continue to permeate. Is that going to introduce more difficulties for both customers or marketers, do you think, going forward? Or do you just see this as an ongoing trend which will just be welcomed by all parties and the overall marketing process will continuously improve as people get more slick in terms of the marketing process?
I think it's something that will just continue. I mean, we're already seeing the use of data that otherwise will not necessarily be seen as traditional marketing data coming into the mix. I have a client who is a large conference and exhibition organizer, and they have been using weather and travel information to run alongside their attendance records to actually try and understand people who have registered for an event but not turned up. Was this as a result of just sort of wanton disinterest, or was it because travel was held up in either in the area where the exhibition was or where they were coming from, or the weather had a similar effect? So what I'm saying is another of these situations where you can overload data, and we hear a lot about the concept of big data, and I really don't want to get into that today because that's a subject on its own. But there are ways of using additional data to give answers to particular questions that I think are going to be made that much easier by the modern technology that allows the integration of data sources from outside the organisation to a greater extent.
So it's that holistic view around data sharing, data insights.
The data vendors, so people that are selling sort of travel and weather and specialist information are all building their systems with the necessary hooks and APIs that are there ready for the marketing systems to come in and exchange data with them. And it's exploiting those to the right level that I think we're going to see more of.
Okay. I just wonder if perhaps we can just stay on that thought for a moment and maybe go through an experience you may have had yourself in terms of the derivation of perhaps an unplanned or unforeseen insight from an initial starting point of let's look at our data, and maybe take us through a process you may have gone through yourself in identifying or realising some sort of unexpected insight.
Well, one that springs to mind is with the same exhibition company, who were running their various exhibitions as individual products, and therefore they were in silos, and the data didn't tend to go across from one to the other. And certainly the people running those exhibitions never spoke to the people that were running at other exhibitions. So there was unbelievably a lack of understanding that somebody who was a major exhibitor in one exhibition was also a visitor to another exhibition. And this person would exist with both hats on, if you like. But because there was no sharing of data, this wasn't recognised. And what actually happened was, because of their their total lack of understanding of there being an enterprise-wide view of this person, the next time they registered for an exhibition in another sector, another business sector, and this was totally valid because a particular individual could have an interest in more than one business sector, the company he worked for on the database changed the sector that it was operating in. So overnight, one of the biggest petrochemical businesses in the world became a supermarket operator on the database because nobody had thought to cross-reference the information that was coming in from the different silos of exhibition. So the same guy who was responsible in a large petrol company for the forecourts, and that included the forecourt supermarkets, visiting both the petrochemical industry show and the supermarkets show, because he put down he was involved in supermarkets, overnight that petrochemical company on the database became a supermarket company, and therefore nobody in that company worldwide was invited to the next petrochemical event. So those are the kind of things that analysis of the data and looking at how data is collected can sometimes reveal. And then that means you can't just sit there and say, oh, look what's happened. It means there needs to be some kind of formulation of a more robust data strategy and also a sharing of the responsibility across the whole business for the managing of the data asset.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
That sounds like an excellent example of perhaps an over-reliance on arguably technology or data, really, and allowing that process to kind of manage itself rather than
In my view, it's actually an under-reliance on technology. Because actually had the technology to match the people, then this would have shown up straight away, and it wouldn't have waited for the likes of me to go in and start looking under the hood of the data to see what skeletons I could find in the cupboard to reveal it.
And of course, the financial implications on that type of scenario
are huge, because the petrochemical company was sending hundreds of people to conferences and exhibitions, but that year they weren't invited.
Right. Interesting. So certainly a good example of how data or misuse of data can hinder a marketing exercise. Yeah. Okay. Before we throw questions out to the audience, let me ask you one more question. So in terms of your new, approaching new clients, perhaps clients who have some way to go on the marketing maturity curve, let's put it, are there any sort of fundamental bits of advice you would offer to a budding marketing function within an SME?
I think probably the most important thing is to make sure that all of your communication channels are integrated.
Right.
So, in other words, a great deal of time is spent on developing a fabulous website, and nobody has thought about when somebody fills in a form on the website, what happens to that data? Or even, are we actually using the same fields of data on the web form that we've got on the database? So there becomes, again, a disconnect of that information. A lot of new CRM solutions, customer relationship management solutions, are now coming with a content management system and website front end ready integrated.
Fully integrated.
Yeah, it's a combined package, yeah. Which is probably a very good idea. But where you find companies with a limited budget who are saying, what's more important, our website or our database? It seems the website is taking precedence because that's the outward facing. It's the sexy bit, if you like, that is outward facing. But very often, any data winds up in the content management system in a format that can't really be used for them one-to-one marketing.
So it's still a fairly poor experience from a customer perspective either way.
It is, and also it's a bit of a frustration for the marketers.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you, Michael. Are there any questions from the audience at all?
Would you consider having spam filters a bit of a nuisance when it comes to reaching a customer? Because a lot of newsletters that I have end up in the spam list, and sometimes I don't even do anything for it to happen. It just ends up there.
Yeah.
How do you guys countermeasure something like that?
Well, very often it's countermeasured by using a proper email broadcaster to send the stuff out for you, because they'll manage your reputation and they'll manage that for you. If you're a company, and this is something else that I find, is that companies, the people are absolutely scared, I suppose is the word, of going away from Outlook. Okay, we have to send our emails out in Outlook. Well, why? Because your CRM solution has got an emailing facility which will protect your reputation, or you can integrate that with one of the big emailing software providers or service providers, and they'll do the same thing, and they will very often integrate with Outlook, so you can see what you've sent out in your Outlook. So if that's what you're, you know, if that's what you're worried about, it's there. But I do encounter this quite a lot where, and they've got one client at the moment that's had a particular problem where they've been sending out data through their CRM, but the way the CRM sends it out, I don't want to get too technical, is it uses its own format for the for who is sending the email. It doesn't say it's come from Fred Jones. It says it comes from a whole load of gobbledygook. And so the spam filters are going to look at that and say, this isn't a person. This is some kind of automatic thing. We're not going to use it. So we're now working with the software provider to change that so that it does actually have the person's name, or at least a company name or something that's recognisable as something other than a robot sending out a message.
Yeah, because a lot of smaller companies, or at least less reputable companies, for example, some of them in China, some of them in Thailand, things like that, you know, mass producers in terms of whatever cheap things you have to buy, they usually use botnets, and botnets are very dangerous in the same way, but they're very dangerous, but at the same time, they can very easily be used for newsletters or telling customers that, oh, we've got this new product that you guys might want to know. You know?
So therefore, it's understandable why the recipient company, especially if you're sending it to a business-to-business, why those businesses will have those filters on for that kind of thing. But if you can actually make sure that that it's coming from a recognisable domain and you get your customer, and we're telling the customer, this is the domain your membership emails are going to come from. Make sure it's in your whitelist, and that it's and it'll be accepted. And this is what they're doing, and they're getting through. So you can understand why they would have those filters on. But sometimes the marketer doesn't understand why it's ending up in that filter. It's all because they're using perhaps their CRM to send it out, rather than using something like a dot mailer or one of the other big broadcasters.
And to be fair, the consumers don't really care what happens, as long as it actually gets to their mailbox. You know what I mean? If you
but the marketer doesn't care either, as long as it gets to the mailbox.
I mean, if you type on the message, don't forget to put this on your whitelist, so they can get all our information. They won't give it. You know, they're just gonna delete it and go, okay. And it will just wither away in your inbox until you actually remember, oh, where's that email? It's a lot like that.
But that's why it's important to have the right relationship with the customer.
Yeah.
The one I'm talking about, they're a membership organisation, and these are actually their members, and the members will want to receive that information.
So it wouldn't be a newsletter.
It can be a newsletter.
It can be a newsletter.
Yeah, but it's all the membership communications. But in terms of just a straightforward commercial relationship, if you've got the right reputation with your customers actually say, yeah, I do want to receive stuff from this company, so I will put it in my white list. But that again is one of the things about email communications as opposed to direct mail. Email communications can be deleted straight off without you reading them. Direct mail, at least people usually open the envelope and start reading the first few paragraphs.
Or just the booklet itself, yeah.
Or even the message you've put on the envelope.
Because personally, I receive both emails and sometimes direct, everyone does. And personally, it looks a lot better when Maplin or Game or whatever sends us an actual booklet with all the stuff that's going to come out this year and all the important things that you might want to look out for than a newsletter that says, click here for our website, and then the website has to load. You have to wait for it to get in.
And then you've got to find the bit you're interested in. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
The booklet has pretty pictures and nice colours. You know, it's just...
Unless there's a way they could incorporate the booklet into the email system.
Well, a lot of companies are doing that, especially in travel, where you will go on, you'll click on, and the website is actually a brochure. And you can actually turn the page, literally turn the page on the screen.
But you can do exactly the reverse and turn the physical booklet onto a website.
Yeah.
But it's very, very expensive, and I'm guessing only some certain companies would do it. Because, as you said, it would be like 60p to do a direct mail brochure. Imagine, I'm pretty sure...
Oh, no. Don't get me wrong. If you the sort of booklet that Game or any of these people send out, that's costing a lot more than 60p.
Yeah, I understand.
I'm talking about a couple of sheets of paper in an envelope
exactly.
is 60p.
Yeah.
That's a stamp.
Exactly,
I'm not actually sure exactly how much the price for manufacturing a certain type of booklet like that is, but what I mean is, if you really, really, really want to, you know, pull out all your stuff, I don't know exactly what the expression is, but still... I'm pretty sure all you guys know what NFC tags are. I'm pretty sure all of our phones here have an NFC reader. There's a massive potential that has been untapped in terms of marketing and advertising, and it's kind of been pushed out through QR readers, QR codes, but honestly no one really cares about that. But if you go at any bus stop, you've got NFC cards. For the advertisement you've got on the left, and NFC readers on the back for the next bus.
Yep.
So we have the technology, we just don't have the infrastructure to get people to do it. So imagine if someone was crazy enough to do a booklet that had NFC tags for every single product, and you just put your phone on it, and it would link you directly to the website. That is vanguardist, I understand. And it probably would cost a lot more than 60p to make.
No, but I'm doing that at the moment with a fashion retailer, where we're actually putting QR codes on the back of the swing tags in the store, on the products that are in the stores, so that what they're able to do, and there's a thing on it that says you can win the cost of this item back. And so they buy, they put it on, it takes them straight to the website, they're able to put their details in, register, get an immediate voucher to use against the product to get a discount, but it also means they go into the prize draw to win the value of that product back.
And you get the customer's details.
And we get the customer's details.
So everybody
exactly,
knows.
Yeah.
So that's the thing about QR codes. I believe that the QR codes are very, very, very useful, and they are very effective if people care about them. And I can tell you that my best friend, he's as much of a techie as I am. He loves his technology, and he's never used a QR code in his life.
Mm.
And I already told him, you have a million of them around you. Open any magazine, it's there.
Yeah.
Go to Subway, and your card will have a QR code on it. But no one cares.
Well,
that's the problem.
So, for example, my wife's a sports therapist, okay? And she's dealing with... sort of keen amateurs and professional elite sports people, let's say with injuries and what have you. On her business card, she's got a QR code. And so all anybody does is go on there, they can go straight to her website, get all the details, make an appointment, everything they want to do. But the business card itself is very sparse. It's just her name and some few details, but it's the QR code we want them to use.
Exactly.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
That's a really interesting, a few interesting examples there about closing the loop, about soliciting feedback from the customer interaction experience. So it's not just mail shots and keeping your fingers crossed that particular customer or receiver of the mail shot responds. It's actually taking this a few steps on.
That's where the whole thing has changed. Traditionally, you would send out a campaign, you knew exactly who you were sending it to, so it was totally controlled, you had a controlled response, you saw how that response was, you analysed it, you changed your strategy next time to improve on what you were doing, and so it would go around in a kind of a, hopefully a corkscrew that went forward. Now, what we've got is we've got a whole bunch of uncontrolled response. People that just come across your website, people that are referred by their friends putting the offer on social media or what have you. So you've got no idea who's actually responding. It's totally uncontrolled. So rather than doing just analysis, you've now got to do interpretation and evaluate that piece of information. How valuable is this new piece of information to my strategy? Do I want to bring this person in and have a relationship with them, or do I just send them the stock answer saying, thanks very much, go to the website if you want more information?
But that's where surveys come into play.
Enter.
You know, a lot of newsletters or websites. Amazon, one for example, massive company anyway, so they've got the infrastructure to do it. But every time I get a delivery from them, they always send me an email about a day after and asking, how was your package? Did you like that? Was it well packed? Was the driver nice? Was it on time? Surveying is as important as selling the thing.
That's right. But that's what I was talking about, touch points. So the next time you go onto Amazon, or next time you go onto another retail you work with, or call them up, this, what the system should be doing is bringing forward to that sales agent or onto that session on the website the next piece of information you want to ask them that's missing from your record. And what I have is I have clients, we actually keep almost like a thermometer in front of the sales agent that shows, you know those things they have outside churches that said, you know,
the church rebuild refund
has now reached this amount. That's what it's like. And it sort of says, this is how far. This customer, we've only got 70% of the information. We now need this piece of information to take it to 80%. And that's how it works. So you're not bombarding, the customer with a survey. You're asking that next one piece of information that you need, because they're going to answer that. If you start putting five questions in front of them on the phone, they're going to get fed up with that and go away.
Because there's a very, very thin line when it comes to
what's acceptable and what's too much. Exactly.
It's a point where it's just asking and the other one's harassing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's a thin line on what is acceptable and what isn't.
True.
And just putting it on another point of view, for the marketers, it's a bit like gamifying it, isn't it? Because if you're putting an objective to them in front of them, it's like, we gotta reach this. We have to get this. This is the next objective.
Yeah.
It's gamifying it. It's making it fun.
It is. It is actually making it fun.
If you make a survey fun or a newsletter fun, people will have more interaction with it. You can't just make a blank sheet and go, okay, this is exactly what we want. You know, it's about how you present it and how you execute it.
Well, that takes us on to another whole area, which we haven't got time for today, which is the single word of engagement.
Which we may have a separate session on. Now you've mentioned that.
Gamify for the marketers themselves, and make the next information.
Oh, no, it's for both. It's for both.
It's customers and marketers.
That's exactly it, yeah.
It makes it more efficient.
Yeah.
When you gamify for the marketers, it'll give them more challenge, but then that will come motivation. And
let's just see how good I am in my sales patter to actually get this guy to give me that piece of information.
You know, get the, it kind of makes you feel better, because people behind the phones and the keyboards and everything, they're humans as well. They're not machines. They like to know that they're doing well, or if they're doing bad, what they can do to improve.
Yeah.
So it's both for the customer and the seller.
Yes.
So both win in this situation.
Which is a very slightly different take on having things like sales targets to impact. This is more of a motivational type of environment.
Well, there are companies out there, a lot of companies out there, that they also measure retention. I mean, not just measure retention, but incentivize retention with their sales teams. So it's not just selling the next product. You might not sell anything on this sales call, but what you've actually done is you've enhanced the relationship, and that's just as reward worthy as actually selling the next product.
For the company I work with Stormfront, the Apple retailer, and how it works in my branch is we have a sales target. We were supposed to hit that target by the end of the week. But what matters most isn't how many iPhones you sold or how many Macs you sold. It's how many third-party things you put on it, how much accidental damage, how much how many customers will come back to buy something else after you told them, right, but we also have this in stock, so if you want to come back for something else, that matters a lot. And it also, what matters as well is returns. A return is worse than not selling anything. Because if you have something that's been returned,
it's a cost.
With no reason whatsoever, that means the customer wasn't happy.
But you're looking at it from the point of view of something like Apple. Look at it from the point of view of a fashion retailer. The average girl will order the same product three times in the order, in three different sizes. And she'll keep the one that fits and send the other two back.
Which would mean that the one that fits, you need to emphasize one bit more.
Yeah, so what you should then do is have that in the CRM system. Next time she goes on, it says, comes on, hey, when you've had another style like this, you've had that size. Or it will just straightforward, just present the size that you know she is. What you don't know is whether she's ordering it for her sister, who's three sizes bigger.
Or a mum.
Yeah. Or a mum.
But not trying to advertise or anything like that. Tesco does that. Every time I get my club card newsletter,
yeah,
it tells me, we've noticed you bought ketchup. We've got a deal on ketchup right now.
Yeah, what they use, and they run it absolutely every single day, is a process called recency, frequency, value. It's an RFV model. And they look at how recently have you bought, how frequently do you buy it, and what do you spend on what when you buy it. And they'll use that either to cross-sell, or more usually, you might wonder, hang on a minute, every time I go into Tesco's, I buy those biscuits, why do they incentivize me to do something I was going to do anyway? It's because you haven't been in for the last 3 weeks. So they're trying to get you back in, incentivizing you on something that you know. I'm the guy that went into Tesco's 3 years before Dunnhumby and tried to sell them on the concept of the Tesco club card. And they told me, go away, we'd never do anything like that.
So just in the interest of time, just one or two quick questions, Michael. Mm. What would you advise somebody who's planning to go into digital marketing or data-driven marketing?
Data-driven marketing isn't necessarily digital marketing.
Right, okay.
Data-driven marketing, you can still be using traditional communication methods.
Right.
I think the thing is not to dismiss it if your interests, this might be a backward way of answering this, not to dismiss it if your interests are outside of marketing. Because what I find is that a lot of people who have an interest in finance, in logistics, their statisticians, they're not necessarily marketers, but there is a need for all of those people to support the data-driven marketing strategy for function.
Okay. Yeah.
And so you might still find yourself doing that. So I would suggest that it's something that one should look at as a means of quite an interesting, lively, fun career. But you don't necessarily have to approach it as a marketer.
Which really adds on to the point of that data culture inside the company.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Interesting. Where can a career in marketing ultimately take you, would you say? Just as a last question.
These days, a career in marketing can take you right up into the CEO.
Right, okay.
There's no reason why a marketer shouldn't be. I say these days because when I first started in marketing, marketing was sort of a peripheral
function off to one side
that people called upon. Now it's much more germane and central to the enterprise.
Fantastic. Michael, guests, thank you very much for your time today. Sorry to draw a very interesting topic to a close, but unfortunately we've run out of time for this week. So once again, thank you very much, Michael. Very interesting, very insightful discussion. And again, thank you to our audience for joining us today and for some great questions and some good debate there. We're looking forward to you joining us again next time. And thank you.
For more information, visit radiolab.beds.ac.uk/businessmatters.